Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And just as we looked to be making this World Cup so similar to the upcoming one now in this year, 2023, we get to a game with Canada in it, which is where these two World Cups split off. So welcome to the Squid Rugby World Cup retrospective. Once again, it's a delight as ever to be joined by Mr. Will Owen. How are you doing?
I'm all right. There's a slightly bittersweet sensation of not having Gavin Henson playing this game, but I'm sure there's some antidote to that that we can at some point achieve.
Well, this is exactly it. This is exactly why, as we look at Wales for the first time in this tournament, we had to get on author, writer, social media, Twitter person, but mostly the world's leading Hensonologist, I would say, Mr. Luke Upton. How are you doing?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much, Robbie. Thank you, Will. I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me on this game and not the Fiji game. Not ready to talk about that in this kind of detail. But yeah, thank you very much for inviting me on this. Obviously, Henson is a big miss from this tournament, and indeed every World Cup since 1999. you know, he could have made that as a 17-year-old playing for Swansea RFC. I think he probably should have. But yeah, he's missing from this tournament. But there were a couple of other decent players in this tournament, so I guess we'll have to press on without him.
Well, you remember up until about 2020, Gavin Henson's description on Twitter was Rugby World Cup 2019.
He's obsessed with going to a World Cup.
Yeah.
And there's another one coming up. There is time yet for Gav.
Gatland's back. Gatland like Gav, you know?
Oh.
The saddest thing was when he made his one appearance in Rugby League, they got on the sort of Rugby League World Cup hype train for Henson.
Yes. But,
I mean, that was a very short-lived thing, but he was asked the question, like, you know, would you go to the World Cup, having not even played a single game of rugby league yet? I think he said yes, but that didn't happen, unfortunately.
I remember looking at ticket prices for the Rugby League World Cup, going, what if Gavin Henson was playing Papua New Guinea in Doncaster and tickets were a fiver? I'd go to watch Gavin Henson play.
It's the worst thing that happened because of the COVID pandemic was them pushing back the Rugby League World Cup a year so Gavin Henson couldn't play in it anymore because he's now 51 instead of 50.
But he still looks 16.
Yeah, I mean, he's looking great still in a different way. But yeah, I think we might have to realise you'll never play in the World Cup for Wales. Maybe as assistant coach or something, hype man, I don't know, in France in the autumn. Let's see what Gatland's comes up with. But he's a fan of his. He never let him down, to quote Warren Gatland, and he hasn't done it yet.
No, absolutely.
Never will.
So, obviously, Gavin Henson is one thing. The one player we haven't mentioned from this book was Geoffyn Hughes, another Welsh player from sort of this era, the subject of your first book. Where was Geoffyn Hughes in lead up to this World Cup?
Geoffyn Hughes, I think, had gone on a poorly timed sabbatical from rugby. I think he'd got involved in the two Welsh obsessions of reality TV and CrossFit, and I think we'd lost him for that. I think he just made his return at the end of the first book, but there's not been a second, so I think he's just sort of floating in the air somewhere. But we, you know, you can imagine he's played in and won a few World Cups since then.
Is that something you'd want to do? A follow up checking in on Geoffyn Hughes later down the line?
I don't know if there is the commercial or public desire for a second Geoffyn Hughes book, as much as I'd like to say there is. I mean, I think everyone who read it did quite enjoy it. This is, if anyone's listening and doesn't know what I'm talking about, which probably is quite a lot of people, I wrote a book about 5 or 6 years ago called Absolutely Huge, which was a kind of a spoof autobiography of a rugby player called Geoffyn Hughes and his sort of crazy talented, but pretty stupid as well. And obviously not at all based on any other Welsh internationals of that era.
Don't think about the initials.
Purely coincidence. Yeah, GH, you know, Geoffyn Hughes. lots of people called GH out there. But yeah, so it was his sort of life and times. And yeah, people did like it. But yeah, I don't know if there'll be a second one. we will see.
Well, there wasn't the public demand for this podcast, and we're still doing it. So,
well, maybe. I was hoping there'd be a bit of like fan fiction or something. You know, other people would take it on for me. But again, no one's done that either. Unfortunately, so we'll see. Maybe we'll revisit him at one point in the time. But he lived in a slightly crazy like Wales when, with all the regions were absolutely all over the place, and it really has sort of come right round to that now. So we will see.
But obviously, it then leads us on to where we are now. Maybe you didn't write the follow-up to Absolutely Huge, but you did write an absolutely huge pair of books afterwards, including most recently, Rugby's Greatest Mavericks. So this has been out for, what, a few months now? And wandering around bookshops when I was in Wales a month or two ago. Everywhere. Every bookshop, copies all over the place. Is it still surreal spotting copies of your book in the wild and seeing it in, you know, Waterstones and the like?
Yeah, it is. So, yeah, on the back of Absolutely Huge, a lot of the publisher who do quite a lot of Welsh books, we've just done the Nigel Owens book, which is obviously a big seller. They invited me to do a book of sort of anthology, I suppose, of hard men of rugby. So 2020, the toughest guys.
You mean this? There we go. I've got a copy of it in my hands. Excellent, I must say. Very enjoyable. It covers all eras. It's very good.
It was a lot of fun to write. Good fun to research. Got to speak to kind of people like sort of Bacchus Berta and Brian Lima and Lee Byrne and players like that. And yeah, it went well. It's very focused on sort of the stories, the characters of people rather than the kind of the stats and things like that. And then off the back of that, I thought there's another book a bit like this that I could do. So yeah, did one on Mavericks, which was out in the middle of October. So similar kind of thing, 20 men and women in the last sort of 80 years. And yeah, some of them are sort of mavericks sort of on the pitch. So I suppose someone like Serevi, you know, the classic, you know, running with the ball in one hand, you know, all that kind of thing, through to people like, well, David Pocock, it's obviously someone that you guys know well, who is not really a maverick on the pitch, but because of his sort of stance off the pitch and his attitude towards sort of social issues, and the fact he is now a liberal independent senator at the age of 32 makes him a maverick. And that was really good fun. Spoke to David Campese for it. He wrote the foreword very kindly. He was great fun. I mean, exactly how you'd imagine David Campese to be. Within 30 seconds on the phone to me, he's dropping his truth bombs about all kinds of things. But yeah, great fun. Yeah, so that was out in October. And yeah, it is quite surreal to sort of see the books out and about. You know, it's lovely when people, you know, tweet me, who I don't know, to say, you know, got your book, I really enjoyed it. You know, it's really lovely when people kind of make the time to do that. So yeah, it's nice to be, you know, nice to be out there and obviously to talk to a few people like sort of, you know, David Campese. I spoke to Joel Stransky as well. People that have sort of, you know, just grown up watching on the telly, and I'm just, like an ordinary bloke. And suddenly you're kind of having a chat with this guy, and it's, you know, and they're lovely and they're helpful and they're friendly. So yeah, really positive. Put me in a good frame of mind for this podcast, because I spent quite a lot of time on YouTube and ESPN Scrum, kind of looking up exactly when this guy played. I mean, ESPN Scrum is just the best thing in the world, really, I think.
The loss of it, I still feel every day. I weep a single tear every morning when I first wake up for the loss of ESPN Scrum.
This podcast is very much powered by ESPN Scrum. I think us and every guest we've ever had has relied on ESPN Scrum for any statistics that have ever come up in here.
The point in the
internet. Anything going on recently, I don't know how people write about it.
Yeah.
I really don't.
Yeah. He's so reliant on all rugby, which is so much less comprehensive. But, you know, a useful resource nonetheless. But, and you've got to split them and compare them, put the two together. It's a nightmare.
Yeah. You know, Wikipedia is obviously very helpful, but having like read people's autobiographies and definitive works on people, and then I've looked on their Wikipedia page, and yeah, that is wrong. That is like people's birthdays are wrong on Wikipedia, and you know, clubs and things like that are often incorrect. And I think probably before doing these books, I sort of took it a little bit more as gospel, kind of like the wisdom of crowds will sort it out. But no, there's actually quite a lot of errors on there. So I never found any errors in ESPN Scrum. God bless it.
Never. Absolutely never. So when it comes to like narrowing down the list to 20, knowing that's coming,
yeah,
do you have an initial idea of most of the players you want to do? Do you have some that you come across whilst you're researching? Or do you have a kind of, do you find it very much as you're writing? Like, what's the process in nailing down the 20 and finding the 20? And is it just you having a kind of great knowledge of rugby and of past players that can bring this out?
Yeah, it's a bit of both, really. I mean, I have to, you know, it is a commercial, you know, enterprise. I mean, it doesn't make me much money at all. There's better ways to earn that money, if you know, or easier ways, I should say. So it has to be sort of run by the publisher a little bit. So, you know, you have to be kind of mindful of different audiences and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the 20, I think there were some ones that very obviously came to mind that are sort of very, very sort of straightforward. And then there's ones that are a bit more unusual. So I think in the last book, I read a book in Mavericks, I read a book about protests about the South African tour of Ireland and the UK in the 70s, the anti-apartheid protest. It was, you know, absolutely huge, huge thing. And the tour was massive, went on for about 3 months, but it was a major, you know, major political issue. You know, loads of games were disrupted. And then I read about them in Ireland, and there was a priest kind of leading the so one line about there was a former Ireland international, Marnie Cunningham, led the protests outside the game against Munster. And I just thought, that's kind of interesting, like, you know, who's this guy? Obviously, I'd never heard of him. And then, yeah, kind of looked up and saw he played for Ireland in the 50s, kind of fairly recently died, and then kind of packed in being a rugby player to become a priest. And then I thought that was kind of quite interesting. I read a bit more about him, and couldn't find anything, and then tracked down his nephew, who played for Munster and Ireland A in the 90s, and is involved in sort of club rugby in Ireland. And he basically spoke to him, had a massive chat with him, got some resources. And then that story kind of wasn't really told that much before, and now it's kind of out there.
That's absolutely amazing.
That's incredible.
Yeah, so someone like him, or like Heather Mize, Canadian player, was someone that I wasn't hugely familiar with before. I kind of knew the name, but I didn't know much about her. But then when I started looking into her, I was like, God, she's amazing. With, you know, gold medals in 2 Olympics, decent cyclist as well. And yeah, kind of spoke to her and got that. So I wanted it to be a mix of, you know, people like, yeah, your Campeses, or, you know, from a Welsh point of view, someone like Ray Gravel, who everyone kind of knows Ray Gravel, everyone sort of loves him, but I think people love him so much they're quite happy to spend a quarter of an hour reading a chapter on him, you know. So it's a bit like, yeah, a bit of a mix. You don't want it to be all, oh, I know all these guys, or you don't want it to be, who the hell are these people? You want to try and get a little bit of a mix. And I actually think that the feedback I've got has been that the kind of Marnie Cunninghams and the Heather Moyes and Non Evans as well have been, people have really kind of enjoyed those. And I think people have enjoyed then learning a bit more about, I had a chapter on, you know, Christoph Dominici, and obviously he's, you know, pure entertainer, a flair player, but obviously he had terrible mental health issues that, you know, were with him all through his life, and ultimately, well, led to his passing. So I think kind of weaving that into it as well. And then someone like, you know, James Small, South African winger in the 1995 World Cup final. Again, he's sort of like a bit of a bad boy of rugby and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the Harley and the leather jackets and the women and the drinking and stuff like that. But again, there was a lot more to him from his family and his life. And, you know, the time he was playing was a very complex time in South African rugby, because it was obviously coming out of apartheid into the democratic era, and so coming out of the ban. But he was the only white guy on the team of non-Dutch heritage, so he was of a British heritage. So he basically got the shit kicked out of him quite a lot going through the ranks. So he had this sort of outsider status when he came in, so it was actually far more sympathetic to the wider problems in South African culture than perhaps some other players would be. You know, but it's obviously all nuanced. So, you know, I think kind of you can write about him, and you can write about some of the cool stuff on the pitch, and, you know, the 95 Cup final against Jonah Lumu, but then kind of framing it in within this sort of wider sort of context of the sort of society at the time, and then the man himself. So yeah, those were chapters really, you know, were really interesting to write. Obviously, you know, took a long time on them because it's quite a hard thing to write about, and you can't be flippant about it, and it's you know, obviously James Small,
sensitive issue. Yeah.
Yeah. So I spoke to a South African friend about that chapter and sort of said, I've read this, is this right? Because you know what it's like when someone writes about something that you know about, and it's a clunky, you can spoil a mile.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's really, really good fun to sort of put together. And yeah, people seem to quite enjoy them. It's all, you know, the chapters are about sort of 3,000 or 4,000 pages, words long. Four thousand chapters each.
I can't say you don't work hard.
I don't know if you have the same thing that I do all the time, that I find it so much easier to try and tell a story like a, you know, like the Marnie Cunningham thing. Obviously, you know, it's a story I like nobody else knew before the book. Or like you've got the chapter on Pride of Long Eaton, Alexander Obstansky. You know, those stories feel easier to tell than just writing necessarily about someone like Finn Russell or Sergio Parise, who are in the book as well, who are just, you know, for their playing ability. Like, it's easier, to approach from a storytelling point of view. I don't know if you find the same thing.
Yeah. 100%. I mean, I think if I was going to, not that I would do this, but if I was going to sort of rank order my favourite chapters in the book, I'd probably have Parise towards the bottom. Mm. No sort of disrespect to him, but...
Because he will come and find you if he thinks so.
I know what you mean, no, though, because... you're right, that there's a lot of stories that I think are more kind of an untold nature to them. And I think that what's fascinating about what you do is, as you say, telling new stories that deserve to be heard, you know, and I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, thank you. I think, for someone like Parise, you know, you've looked at the book, so you kind of know what I do. I try and find a sort of a hook at the start, you know, a particular aspect of their life or career that's really interesting. And then, you lead it from there. So, you know, Parise, I basically found that he just sort of lost most of his international games. You know, he'd lost 88% of his international games, something like that. So, you know, what does that mean to a player, to a person, to go into so many games? You know, he'd runs where they lost every game in like 3 years, I think. Or certainly every game against Tier 1 opposition. So what does that sort of do to the man? So that's the kind of the bit that I sort of found interesting with him, I guess.
For sure.
But it's good. And I think, you know, a few people have asked me about kind of Mavericks today and things like that. And I do think they are still there. I mean, I think Finn Russell definitely is one, I think, on the pitch. Mm. And I think, you know, I think off the pitch a bit as well. And there is a sort of hinterland there, you know, the years in the stonemason's yard and all that sort of stuff. And I think Cipriani is someone that I probably a bit surprised about, really, you know, coming from it from a sort of Welsh point of view. You know, I did think he was just a bit of a stereotypical kind of posh English guy. He was obviously a good player, but he was more interested in nightclubs and girls and stuff than playing. And I think there was a little bit of that in there. But again, there's a sort of a context as to why he was like that. He's not a posh guy at all. His mum worked incredibly hard to get him where he was. And I think he was like badly treated. I think Eddie Jones treated him quite badly. I think when under the right managers, which he did have at certain times, he could have been could have achieved a lot more, but he didn't really achieve much for England at all, actually. But yeah, I think with anything, once you start like digging into it a bit more, it becomes a bit more complicated. You know, if I wanted to give him an absolute hatchet job in there, I couldn't have by the end of it, because I felt sorry for him. And I saw the Instagram video up after Caroline Flack passed away, and it was incredibly seeing a bloke, you know, a guy who I don't know in any way, but seeing someone just like put themselves out there, like completely open themselves up to the world, you know, whoever they are, I think is always quite moving. So there are still Mavericks out there, but I think there's less room for it. I certainly don't think Joe Marler's a Maverick.
No,
no. He likes to think of himself as one.
I've got a word that rhymes with the second half of Maverick that I would call Joe Marler. I'd call him a prick. I think it's really interesting what you say about, in a way, the definition of what a Maverick is in rugby today has kind of changed. That, like, we talk about Finn Russell. Obviously, on the pitch, there is, I don't think anyone can argue that he is one of the bravest, kind of biggest kind of risk takers in a rugby sense as possible. But, like, off the pitch, it's insane to think that his thing of, like, when he came out a few months ago and said, oh, I'm aware I could be a much more physically gifted player, but I love burger and chips too much. And, like, comparatively to how, to, you know, the nth degree of, like, what professional athletes and rugby players specifically go through, like, nutritiously and so on, like, that does make him different from the norm. The amount of, like, nutrition, you know, dietitians and stuff, he will have told to fuck off, essentially, so he can live his own life. In a sense, that does make him a maverick.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think he has a different view of the game, I think, to a lot of other people. I don't think he still thinks of it as a game.
As
a bit of fun, which I think certainly quite a few of the guys in the olden days did, I think, as a release for them. This was really cool. This is really fun. Lions trips were, you know, trips of a lifetime, trips that you would never, ever, ever go on if it wasn't for this.
Yeah.
And you had to take 3 months off work. So a lot of these guys lost their jobs and stuff.
Yeah.
For going on Lions trips. So you've got to really want to do it. But yeah, like, you know, I like Finn Russell. I'm kind of interested to see what he does next, what the Scotland shake-up looks like from this year.
Oh,
will be quite interesting. Soap opera.
We were just talking about that before you appeared, but it's all a mess. That's a whole state, and who knows where that's going.
There are 400 pages to be written on that.
Minimum. That's just on Finn and Gregor together. So, right, to focus in a bit, there's a couple of players in the book that overlap with Zira. Unfortunately, one of them not being Gavin Henson. But the game today is Wales' somehow eventual 42-17 win over Canada. Wales and Canada's opening game of the 2007 World Cup. Both of them were coming in on not great years, but years in which there'd been mild causes of optimism. So Wales had a pretty terrible Six Nations, then won the last game against England, and then not done particularly well in the warm-ups either. You know, they've been battered by England by 60-odd points at Twickenham. Whereas Canada, again, hadn't had a great year. You know, they got beaten by a lot of A teams. They had games against like New Zealand Maori, Island A, and they were battered comprehensively. But then the last game before the World Cup, well, no, they beat Portugal 42-12 and they beat the USA by 50 points. So both teams were kind of on mixed form, I guess. But Luke, as a Wales fan, where were you around this World Cup? What are your memories of this tournament and, you know, the lead-in and this first game in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think that England warm-up game, I think, is probably the worst Wales game I've ever watched, I think. I watched it in a pub in Twickenham, weirdly. Oh, not in Twickenham, thank God, but in Twickenham.
I watched Wales England with a friend of the pod, Ali Stokes, in a pub in Twickenham that had a massive picture of Martin Johnson on the entranceway. It wasn't that one, was it?
Oh, it might have been. I watched it with some. I just graduated university that summer, and I watched it with a bunch of my mates from uni who were English. And I think they started. You know, it was one of those ones where they just stopped sort of celebrating once, like. ninth Easter try went in, or whoever it was who scored that day. And the tries were really regular, weren't they? There was one every 5 minutes. It was just, and they, I think they just sort of stopped celebrating. I think I just looked so distraught. So I actually watched this game on my own in a pub, the Nag's Head pub on Upper Street in Islington, which I don't think is there anymore. So yeah,
it's
not long with London.
Though. To commemorate you watching this game there.
I watched a lot. Yeah, I used to watch a lot of rugby there, actually. Obviously would have seen, you know, the following year would have seen some really good stuff there in 2008.
Yeah.
But yeah, watched it there on my own, not a lot along having moved to London. Couldn't lure any of my English mates out to watch the Wales Canada
after what you'd been through. They dragged you out to watch Wales get battered by England. They owed you one.
I know, but you know, I've got three very small children at the moment, so like an afternoon on my own in the pub, probably with a copy of The Observer, you know, it sounds absolutely blissful right now, even with the huffing and puffing that Wales would do over the next sort of 80 minutes. But yeah, and it's weird, I kind of remember it. I think it's one of those things, like when you go somewhere new, you kind of remember quite a lot of the early stuff, but I couldn't remember anything really of the game, apart from a false memory of Gareth Thomas scoring a try. So I remembered we won, and I remembered we like laboured a bit, but that was it. So yeah, very nice to revisit it, and I watched it without knowing the score, so I watched it almost as live as I could.
That was it. I had no memory of this game whatsoever, and I thought I knew what happened. I felt like I'd seen at least highlights recently. Turns out I was completely off on all of it, and I didn't recognise any of this game at all. It felt like fan fiction from an era. And at halftime, I was like, oh, do Canada go on to win this? Like, is this an iconic victory that no one brings up?
Honestly, it felt like kind of a parody of what being a Welsh rugby fan is like. is it was like, oh yeah, well, you know, usually we it's happened a lot just over the lifetime of any Welsh fan that you watch a lot of games where you go into it going, Wales should win this comfortably, and then they have a bit of a scare, or sometimes, you know, we lost to Georgia last year, you know, and you have situations like that. And this felt like a parody of that, of just like, oh yeah, well, Canada are like going to be like really convincingly the better team at halftime. And it felt like a horrible fever dream.
It's funny as well. Like the team feels like such a sort of a present team. Mm. Look at it and like, oh, I know all those players. You know, normally you look at these things. Oh God, that guy, I remember him. God, yeah. But now it's like, no, all 15 of the first 15, like big careers on all of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they really struggled, and Canada, the score was very unflattering on Canada, I would say, at the time.
Certainly was.
Yeah.
Like looking at that Welsh team. And I mean, as you say, the team comes up, you're like, oh, this is a really strong side.
When you see that front row of Jenkins, Reese and Jones, you go like, oh yeah, 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 we're winning this by 50 points.
That's the starting Lions front row in the next tour.
Yeah.
You know, then you've got Alan Wynne-Jones in the second row, who they mention repeatedly as young every time he's involved, which is great. Then you've got Shane Williams, World Player of the Year the following year, in the back line. You've got Mark Jones, really talented player. Tom Shanklin has a great year under Warren Gatland coming up, you know, perfectly good player. Dwayne Peel captaining Wales for the first time. Peel,
Kevin Morgan, like really experienced campaigners who have had some good campaigns before this. It's a really strong team with a stacked bench. Okay.
And like Peel was the starting nine for the Lions in the previous tour, one of the few bright sparks over that whole. Martin Williams, you know, like it's a really, really strong Welsh side.
All listeners thinking like, oh, where's this going to go wrong? I can't wait. Luke, do you have any like sort of favourite players that stand out from that Welsh team in this era?
I mean, Kevin Morgan, I would say, would be my favourite of the backs there. Being a Swansea RFC fan going into the Ospreys sort of era, you know, he was absolutely fantastic at 15 for the Whites in the last years of the club game. You know, we always really enjoyed him. I mean, yeah, the front three, incredible, really. It's funny, like Matthew Rees had his autobiography out the same time I did Absolutely Huge.
Oh, wow.
So we did a couple of, so I kind of hang around with him a bit because we did a couple of book signings together, like joint book signings.
How do you explain the setup of that book to Matthew Rees?
I had quite a lot of time chatting to him to do so. Mm. So he did, you know, I think he did get a copy in the end. It was quite funny because I didn't really sell many books of these things, but he did. Because it's like me and him sitting next to each other at this table with our like stacks of books in front of us and people coming along saying, oh, Matthew, I saw you play here, or I met your, you know, I know your mother from so-and-so. And then they look at me and look at this book. I'm like, oh, hiya. And then go back to talking about Scarlett. Yeah, he was a lovely guy. And I think a little bit of an underrated player for Wales as well, actually. I think when they you know, when people do the big list of great front row forwards, I think he's not always perhaps as high as he should be. Yeah. But yeah, I thought it was a great team. I'm sure we'll get to this. You know, the problems are perhaps up in the stands rather than on the pits. But yeah, but it was a strong Canada team as well. I mean, obviously less familiar, but looking into who they were playing for and that kind of thing. And a lot of them played for top clubs at that time.
Oh, and if you look through that Canada squad, as you say, it's a pretty good Canada squad. And they still have a reasonable number of locally based players or players playing in Canada. But when you look at them, they're Aaron Carpenter, who is a youngster who goes on to, you know, play for them for another 15 years. Pat Riordan goes on to captain them a couple of World Cups time. You had Adam Kleeberger, goes on to be their player of the tournament the following World Cup. You had a young captain called Nate Hirayama, who would go on to play for them for another three World Cups.
Sevens legend as well.
Yeah, it's just kind of constantly the majority of the players who are locally, you know, a young winger comes in, wins his third cap in this game, called DTH van der Merwe, playing in for James Bay at the time.
Goes on the river, James Bay.
World Cups. Yeah. Like, all of their players who aren't, as you say, currently playing at big clubs go on to have big futures. It's a mix of players who are currently kind of peaking, as it were. Mm. You know, they're like, there's a bunch throughout that team. Like, Shawn Michael Stephen was playing for Béziers at the time and was apparently their player of the season the year going in amongst
horrific
all
lid
other
on him, though.
Oh, I mean, yeah, we don't want to talk about that.
He's Sean Dash Michael Stephen as well, isn't he? I like to look that up.
Yes.
I was thinking of a Heartbreak Kid, WWF. I was thinking of Shawn Michaels. I had to look it up and I was like, wow, that's a bad name.
It's just a list. It's just a list of guys. It's a register. Someone is reading out the register. And they go, but if you stop reading through that Canadian team, you've got from 8-9, you're going Shawn Michael Stephen, Morgan William.
Yes.
Anda Munro.
I think,
you know, could
all
work
of
well.
all of the surnames in this Canadian team are taken up in Daniel Howman van der Merwe. Like, he's hogging all of the surnames in that team. Everyone else is just straight first names. Also,
you mean the South African van der Merwe, to quote the commentator. Twice, I think. He had the key, I think, yeah, he said the South African van der Merwe. And who's the other one? The
Kiwi Culpin, yes.
Kiwi Culpin, yeah. Didn't say the Kiwi Parker, though, for us.
No.
But, like, Craig Culpin was born in British Columbia.
He's Canadian. He's Canadian. Let it go.
Like, he lived in New Zealand for a bit as a kid and a teenager, then moved back to Canada. Like, let it go.
To quote James Bay once again.
Of course, the really important thing in that Canada team, right, is for anyone that listened to our series on 2011, I was so excited to realise that my favourite player in all of the world, the Titanium 10 himself, Anda Munro, was back.
Words out of my mouth.
Who I adore. He was a fly half who played like a number 8 and also was an incredible fly half. Like, he played like the kind of, when you see occasionally like Faletau or Surveyor or someone will do a great kick and you go, cool, you know, you can play him at 10. Except he did play at 10 and he was great.
What Munro is like is when the first team number 8 has come back from injury and needs to play a game of thirds to check he's up to speed. He's like yes. That permanently. What a fly off.
Love him. So excited to see him back there. I also discovered around this that he is the grandson of Hector Munro, the Baron Munro of Langholm, which is a ridiculous title and was a like pioneer of flight in Scotland, which wow. is absolute nonsense. But
I have no idea what anything you just said means.
Hector Munro, Baron Munro of Langholm, sounds like a vampire. It's a vampire's title, which is what I take. Anda Munro was a vampire, and that's why he was picked at 10. He was kind of like a controversial pick. He was a kind of youngster when they had the more preferred Ryan Smith, who was playing for Montauban at the time, and also Derek Daypuck, who had been which is a incredibly Canadian name.
It certainly is.
You've got Derek and a reference to hockey in his name. played for them on the previous tour. They played Wales a year earlier in the Millennium Stadium, where Wales had won 61-26, and he'd played 10 in that game.
This should be a breeze then.
Yeah, so it should have been really easy. You know, they played them twice in the lead-up in this kind of World Cup cycle since the last World Cup. They played them once in Toronto, where Wales had won 60 points to 3, and then once in Cardiff, where Wales had won 61-26. This should be really easy. As we get
I think the whole thing was cursed from the moment Bob Simmons on commentary says, ah, and now we're in the beautiful city of Nantes, which has turned into a Welsh province. And I thought, this is not going to age well, because I know that city for one reason and one reason alone.
Yeah, I did like Bob Simmons' voice, though. A lovely voice.
Yeah, kind of good commentator.
There wasn't much about him online at all.
No.
To work for HGV, I think he must have been quite an old man, maybe 2007. I think he must be quite long retired. But yeah, it's a lovely, you know, I thought he had a lovely voice, quite a sort of posh, sort of Monmouthshire school teacher sort of voice.
Yes. Me, you know? No, I was a big fan of Bob Simmons.
Yeah, I got a lot of time for him.
His very steady, he does his research, he learns the players, he turns up, he commentates on the game, he has no personality or opinions on the game.
No ego.
I appreciate
what
the commentator. I liked him taking a moment to the presenter introducing the game says, Nantes, not a city, it's got a great deal of rugby heritage, there's no rugby happening up there, haha. Then Bob Simmons gives you a brief introduction, a brief history of all rugby in Nantes ever, which is incredibly detailed. And he talks about when he came to a game 40 years ago, which was one of the most iconic ever, and he apologizes for it being a personal anecdote. And I love that.
Bless him, he's very cuddly, isn't he, Bob Simmons?
He is.
Yeah, got a lot of time for him. As well, before we do the national anthems, not that we're going to do the national anthems, we don't need to do that. But there's a moment of silence for Sir Tasker Watkins before the game.
Uncle Tasker.
Yes, legendary Welsh, not only rugby player, but war veteran and just just general, like, if there is anything that needed doing in Wales, he basically did it for like a decade. And there's now a statue outside him in the Millennium Stadium. And there was Eddie Butler did a really good piece on him for the BBC a few years back, which I don't know if that's online, but if it is, it was extremely worth watching. And I learned a lot, which is mad because he's our uncle and we should have known all that anyway.
He's our grandparents' uncle.
Yeah.
Whatever that makes you.
Great
thing is that's. So the great, or is it cuz? No, it's
great, see, great uncle.
He's related to our grandmother. And they knew each other and grew up together.
Wow.
So a bit of it is that, you know, Wales isn't that big and you bounce it. If you get 20 guests on this podcast from Wales, one of them will be related to Tasker Watkins, no doubt. But yeah, so I grew up with, you know, hearing stories about him and grandma always having things to say about how kind and generous and warm a person he always was.
He won the Victoria Cross, didn't he?
Yeah. Like as highly decorated as someone can be.
Went
on to become chairman of the Welsh Rugby Union because he just loved rugby and that was, you know, a great passion in his life.
He would have been a great guest on this pod, wouldn't he?
We've tried,
that's it. The next way was the Fiji game, right? We're gonna get a spirit medium in and they're gonna try and contact from the dead both Tasker Watkins and that Welsh team, the Welsh sense of national identity that died during that game.
That's very cool though to have him in the family because I remember watching that Eddie Butler thing, an incredibly impressive man, and I think what he did in World War II, he was so young as well at 21, 22, like as an officer and stuff, fair play. So yeah, nice minute silence there.
We didn't mean that as a boasting about a family, that wasn't
This is which Welsh international are you related to, Luke?
This is
I don't think I am, unfortunately. There's a very famous Welsh rugby player called Billy Upton from Swansea, who people seem to think I'm related to, but I am not. There's three different Upton families in Swansea, and we're not his one, I'm afraid. So no.
Just guessing Hughes.
No, Alan Wynne-Jones was a year below me in school. That's probably closest thing I've got to being related to any rugby players.
You can't skim over that. You've got
as good a name drop as physically possible.
I don't know him, you know, but he was here below me in Bishop Gore school in Swansea. Big lad even then. He was in school for years, I think the first 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then he went to Clandovery College. Mm-hmm. So yeah, left the comprehensive school and went to the nice school in Clandovery. But yeah, he was very, very big from a young age. I think he was almost too big when he was like year eight playing rugby. I think he sort of disrupted the scrum a bit and stuff. Obviously, he came into himself a little bit later on, I think it's fair to say.
Do you?
And his dad was my dad's solicitor as well.
Oh, wow.
A little more business, do it all as well. He's a big lad as well, Mr. Jones Sr. He was a big lad. So, good family. But yeah, not related to anyone, I think. Not that I'm aware of anyway.
Right. If someone that was a year below me in school went on to play football for England, I may not have known about it until you find out years later. You know, like, was it clear at that point that there was something different and he was special? Or was it just something you realised years later? You're like, oh, he was the kid from the year below. Like,
yeah, I mean, at the time, I kind of knew of it just because he was just, and there's quite a funny photo that does the round sometimes of like his class and stuff where he is clearly like a head taller than everyone else. I think everyone knew he was quite big. I think he punched one of my friends in primary school.
Oh, yes.
That's his claim to fame, was that he was punched by Alan Wynne-Jones.
That's the dream.
I think everyone sort of knew he was big and quite good. And then he went away to private school. But obviously he still played for Bonn and Mine. And he sort of played with like lads that I was in school with. And then he obviously kind of rocked up at Swansea RFC at like 17 or something like that. But yeah, I mean, you know, school obviously very, you know, very proud of him. And he's been back to Bishop Gore a few times for sports days, stuff like that. And obviously he lives in Mumbles, so he lives where he grew up. But yeah, it's nice to see his little blonde flex coming out of his scrum cap in this game as well. Nod to the sort of surfing heritage of where he's from.
Well, it is. It's just, as I mentioned, like every time Alan Wynne gets the ball, it is the youngster Alan Wynne-Jones, very young second row Alan Wynne-Jones, which feels so weird now. But the thing is, you know, this was by the end of the year, this could be 5 World Cups ago for him. Like it's really different era of Alan Wynne.
could join the five club.
Early on in the game, he gets dump tackled by DTH Van der Merwe.
Oh my God, how insane is that? And like, DTH probably murders him. Like,
he picks him up, drops him back, Alan Wood drops the ball.
Completely legal.
Ridiculous.
Nails him, yeah. You've just got to hand it to DTH. Like, I thought DTH was really good in this game, particularly in the first half. But it was very much like, the tone around it was like, oh yeah, it's this promising youngster who's coming. And, but the thing is, like, to us, that's like, oh yeah, that's a Canadian legend. That's one of the best players of all time.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
We're pretty much into the game
now, aren't we?
I mean, from the off, I think Canada looked like the more comfortable team, like straight away from the start, because their kicking game from the start is just fantastic. So they have, we've mentioned Ander Munro, we've mentioned Morgan Williams, and then they've got the Kiwi from British Columbia, Craig Culpin, playing in the centres with Dave Spicer, who I'm not familiar with. But the axis of all of those players was that it's quite a modern tactic of getting outside the 10 channel, bringing, you know, the opposition's kind of wingers up and playing with their back three a little bit and then kicking it in behind, which Canada just seemed to have down to a T, which they're the first team I've seen in this World Cup that have done that, like, as a tactic.
So their coach, Rick Suggett, who was a highly celebrated coach who'd actually come through women's rugby and had coached the Canadian, initially sevens and then Canadian women's 15s teams and then moved on to the men's 15s. He died, he had a very sudden brain aneurysm about 5 years ago now, man. And died very suddenly. But he was really highly thought of as a coach and as a kind of tactician, which is why they kept moving him forward and kind of basically bumping him up jobs as it was seen at the time in Canadian rugby and moving him from, you know,
very much
basically
the way
ended up coaching. He ended up coaching all four Canada national teams and the men's and women's 15s and 7s, which I don't know if anyone else has ever done that.
Yeah.
Anyone else has ever been involved there.
People could have done that, a top-end international job. Like,
yeah.
It might happen with, like, some of the really lower-down kind of, like, ranked nations from both the men's and women's game. But for a World Cup team, that's just unheard of.
Yeah.
So, great Canadian name as well.
Yes. Rick Suggett.
Great celebration from him. You know, really, like, enthusiastic.
Yes.
Like, brilliant, you know. Like, look, what you want to see.
He's celebrating like he's the on-field captain, isn't he? Like, every time they score a try or get a big turnover or something. And I think that's great, like, the energy he clearly pumps into these players. And, like, you can tell that, and it sounds almost cliched, but you can tell that this is a group who really believe in what they're being coached off the field.
There's a moment when they turn Wales over, when Wales are in the 22 in the first half. And it cuts up to him, as you say, he's really celebrating it in the stands. And it is the celebration of a coach who thinks this is a game we can win, rather than a coach who thinks we're punching above our weight, or a coach who's, you know, kind of conceded himself that we're going to keep the score down. It's he has a look on his face the whole time of this is our chance to win a game against a Six Nations team.
Yeah.
Because they clearly see Wales are faltering a bit in the lead into that year, and they probably targeted this game as the big one that they can win. And Canada were by so far the better team in that first half.
Yeah.
Like,
they look mentally stronger by miles.
Like, yes, the eventual scoreline of 42-17 flatters Wales, but the scoreline of 17-9 at half time flatters Wales.
Yeah. 100%. And, like, from the start, Munro is just attempting drop goals from anywhere within sort of 40 metres of the Welsh try line. And there's such an air of confidence to everything Canada do. And as I say, like, their kicking game is absolutely on point. And it's only natural that once they've chased absolutely everything, the legs start to slow down a little bit in the second half. They're just fantastic in the first half. And they're just such a joy to watch.
I think for them to start so well And then Wales looked like they sort of took the sting out of it a bit, got a few kicks. And, you know, when you normally watch the lower-ranked team versus the bigger boy, you know, they have a spell, and then it's like that was their chance. But the way that they came right back into it, took the lead, and then built on the lead after half-time. And then even towards the end of the second half, you know, they had chances, didn't they? That they didn't, you know, they didn't take. But it wasn't just one decent spell. It's several good spells throughout the game. I mean, we were a little bit wasteful as well. But, yeah, absolutely, like 17-9. Delighted to have gotten in with that score.
Yeah, and I think two moments that sum up the game are from very similar positions. James Hook at 10 for Wales and Adam Munro at 10 for Canada. Both go for exactly the same kick, trying to pin it 5 metres out from the line. James Hook kicks it dead by a country mile from his, and then Adam Munro nails it into the corner. And it's just like that tiny percentage of both of them seeing the same thing and having the skill set to execute the same thing. But one of them is doing it, and I think has a kind of level of focus on this game that means that they're doing it perfectly, whereas James Hook does not, though I should be careful with the story I mentioned on the previous podcast about criticising him.
Hook is thoroughly outplayed by Munro, I would say, while he's on the field. That's sort of, he gets hooked off about 10 minutes into the second half, like really, really early. But I mean, he does
James.
Yes, exactly. He does land some really good goal kicks to get Wales 9-0 up. Like, there's a point where he misses a goal kick early on that comes off the post. Canada sort of like try and run it out and then give away a stupid penalty inside the 22. Gives him a much easier kick, and I write down, oh, okay. And then I go, hang on, this is James Hook we're on about. And he does get it. But yeah, like, he puts some good kicks in to send Wales to a 9-0 lead. But you still think, like, Wales are punching above their weight here.
Mm.
Yeah. Peel was second best as well.
Yeah.
I mean, Gallant never really liked Peel that much, did he? And I think young, fresh-faced Mike Phillips came on, didn't he, in this game? And obviously by the Six Nations, Mike Phillips is the boy, isn't he, at nine?
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought Peel was overshadowed quite badly. But yeah, I thought Stephen Jones was fantastic when he came on. You know, I mean, I think Shanklin was probably the best back. I thought Shane Williams was quite wasteful, actually, despite getting two tries. I think he could have had a couple more. But yeah, I thought Shanklin, I sort of forget a little bit, I think, what a good player Tom Shanklin was, because he's still such a big kind of media presence, and he looks identical to how he looked then as well.
Yeah.
It was funny on the weekend seeing like Shane Williams, Shanklin and Peel doing their little media bit.
Of course, yeah.
Scarlet's game. And then it's like, oh shit, like I just saw these three like this afternoon looking broadly speaking the same 15 years on. Maybe that's why this team is so present, because so many of them are kind of still sort of in the public eye or what have you.
That's it. All of them in different positions. All of them were about, so you know, Martin Williams is the Wales team manager. Mark Jones was coaching at Worcester, was, you know, offered a job by England.
James at Quinns.
Geffen with Wales. Like a celebrated S&C coach. Yeah, Geffen Jenkins, you say, recently out of Wales. Alan Wynne-Jones is still playing. Jonathan Thomas, likely. There's 3 points in this game where we can hear Jonathan Thomas on the ref mic yell, turnover, turnover. And on none of them, there's a turnover. But he's just very optimistic. And I think that is exactly the kind of skills that Gatlin's looking to bring him in as a breakdown coach. If those rumours are true, that's exactly what he wants. Just someone to be enthusiastic about turnovers. There's something on the thing about turnovers, is something that really stood out as well, is even Alan Rowland obviously goes on to be a villain. Yes, both be a celebrated and acclaimed ref and then a villain further on. Really jarring looking at this kind of, we talk about like the high tackles and all of that standing out and that being different, the tip tackles and what have you. But just the standard of refereeing and how often Wales in particular getting away with tackling from offside positions. And there's one point where Adam Jones has not retreated to anywhere near the ruck and just tackles the scrum half and gets away with it.
Yes!
And there's a couple of moments like that where you just go, this would not fly nowadays. Like, the standard of refereeing has changed completely.
You've got a couple where you go like, oh, it's Martin Williams, that's fine. Like, he knows how to get away with those. We have a couple where you go like, Sonny Parker, where the fuck did you learn to cheat and break the rules and all the time and stuff? I never had him down as one of those.
Oh, they never mention Sonny Parker's from New Zealand, do they?
Yeah. That's
Craig Culpin all the time.
Disgraceful. It's disgraceful. But yeah, no, you're right. Like, really bizarre kind of like vibes reffing going on throughout this.
They don't mention him playing cricket though, do they? He's a dual international, isn't he?
Of course. Forgot about that.
Should have dropped that. If you're doing your Alan Rowland facts, that's always the third one, isn't it? I think, playing cricket for Ireland. Wow. Yeah, I just saw Alan Rowland and then I saw Hook trying to get some kicks away and it began to sort of feed away in my for the next World Cup in my head. So yeah. I began to bring back a few memories of Hulk looking a little pained. And yeah, tried to block that out. But yeah, I thought it was a very entertaining game. I liked how the commentator was trying to frame this as like a Celtic day of rugby. This is a series of matches. But yeah, I think if you like you do in the World Cup, if you just stick on a game that you don't really care about just to entertain yourself after Sunday dinner, I think you'd enjoy it. Quite a lot. I felt a bit sorry for Canada. I think there by the end. I thought funny talking about the team. The one player actually that came on and surprised me was Colin Chavis. Is in my head. He's not quite this era. I know he finished at this World Cup, but he was the only player when he came on. I was like, right, okay. Colin Chavis, yeah. I think that led to the lines about the tightness of the shirts as well, didn't it, from the commentary?
Yes. Yeah, they got really hung up on that briefly, about how tight the Welsh shirts were. Will Greenwood talking about it being sprayed on and, Frank Cotton retired if he had to walk. No, Dorian West. Yeah.
Little joke about his old pal there. But it's funny, I remember Chavis's first game was in 96, and I think it was Jonathan Davis's last game.
Oh wow!
So it's like quite a nice little run through from God knows when Jonathan Davis made his debut to Alan Wynne Jones with just like two or three jumps.
So players. Colin Chavis nearly played with both Jonathan Davises. If he'd played for another year, maybe.
He might have played against because he.
So he I thought about this earlier
for another couple of years.
So Alan Wynne-Jones played with both Gareth Thomases for Wales.
Oh, yeah.
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 So Chavo nearly could have matched him on that, but I guess some of them will have played with two Reece Thomases.
Chavis will have played against Jonathan Davis, I reckon.
Yeah.
For Newport versus Natalie,
I reckon. Last game was in 2009, Chavis.
Yeah, they overlapped. They'll have overlapped.
And Foxy's first cap was in 2009, so...
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, so maybe not an international, but they will have shared a field. He will have shared a field with both Jonathan Davises. There's a fun stat for you. Can we talk some Canadian tries while we're hyping them up? I think there's the Jamie Cubmore try, which happens really quite early on. It's as soon as Wales have stretched their 9-0 lead. And you almost wish that against Wales, like you want Canada to score because they deserve it. So
they really deserve to be ahead. And I said they hadn't quite had a clean cut chance up until then. But like Morgan Williams puts an absolutely brilliant box kick in the lead up as well. Plays absolutely perfectly. He had the first half in particular, he was absolutely phenomenal. Exactly what you want from, if you're a tier two nation, exactly what you want from your captain. That sheer accuracy, command, passion, clearly playing like he was the guy who knew exactly what he was doing. He'd been around the block, you know, had been playing for them since the 99 World Cup, had been around for plenty of time at this point. Yeah, and his kicking was excellent. He made snipes. He takes one quick tap that almost leads to a try for Munro, but you can't take it. And then eventually, they get into this position and Munro switches the play in a very rugby 08 way. and it somehow creates the space that gets him up to within a metre of the line. And after a series of pick and goes, who should be there but prime arch bastard himself, Jamie Cudmore?
A hard man of rugby, if ever you've seen one. I mean... Sometimes overstepping the line, but a character nonetheless, Cudmore.
He was on the long list for hard men of rugby, actually. But I think quite a lot of the stuff he did, there was some sort of legal issues around what you could say about it, because obviously, it's illegal. So I went with Norm Hadley, actually, instead.
Oh, nice.
Canadian guy from the golden era of Canadian rugby. So yeah, I kind of went with him, and there were some good stories of him. And yeah, he wasn't involved in... some of the things that Jamie Cudmore was apparently involved with. But I think we can probably say he was involved with now. I think they are on record, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
But yeah, great for that one, yeah.
No, and then just as you think Canada get themselves back in the game and you're thinking, you know what, they really deserve that. Just as you think, oh, but, you know, it's going to slip away. I've got written in my notes that Canada look the better team than just, in all caps, Shane.
Shane. Oh, man. Just the feeling of, and I think we discussed this in 2011, right? But like the feeling of watching Shane Williams play is something that excites me every time we do a Wales game on this podcast now. Because like, I mean, there was an earlier one where he got the ball, sidestepped Pike, and then threw this like 30-meter pass to Kevin Morgan, who had a run down the wing. But this one where there's a bit of a break and Shane gets the ball in midfield, and it looks like there is absolutely nothing on, and he steps like half the Canadian back line. And it's one of those really unique things that only happened with Shane Williams and a few select other players, where he would just make other players look rapid because they put them in like loads of space. And Ian Goff, right? Not known for his speed, I think he wouldn't mind me saying, but he looked like Ma Nonu running here as he got the ball, skinned someone on the outside, and did a dummy switch pop to Matthew Rhys on the wing.
That was it. I was wondering who put a scrum cap on Wasali Serebi. Like, what happened there? Like, why is Brian O'Driscoll now into anti-vaxxing conspiracy theories?
It was insane. Like, but again, it's one of those things that like Shane put him in that much space that no matter how quick you are, makes everyone look like sevens players, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Leaves Matthew Rhys meter out from the line. Wales in the complete ascendancy. This was a prime era of rugby where defence is backtrapped far less quick, nowhere near as quick as they do nowadays. Like, it's a feature you see nowadays in almost any defence. They're pretty much set up like a second or so after ruck. Like, it's impossibly quick, the rate at which people get back. But that wasn't the case here, even if defence was of a reasonable standard. And so the Canadian defence, you look up, and they have basically two guys back across their entire line. And James Hook looks up and goes, brilliant. They've only got two guys across their entire line. That means I've only got to avoid passing to one of them.
It's just that point where I'm thinking, like, this is a phenomenal Welsh attack. This is incredible.
Yeah.
Shit! Because James Hook throws that pass. He's 5 metres from the Canadian try line, and he throws that pass with the most conviction I've ever seen someone throw a pass. There is so much confidence behind the pass he throws, which goes perfectly into Culpin's hands 5 metres from the Canadian line.
He's got about, let's say, 15 options he could take, right? 13 of them result in a Welsh try. One of them results in Wales being on the attacking on the Canadian goal line. And one of them results in a Canadian try. And he takes the last option.
There are glimpses of the Fiji game, aren't there, in these moments?
Yes, there are.
You know, the lights are on the dashboard. There's little warnings of certain decision-making, the wrong thing at the wrong time. And then enjoying the openness a bit too much, I think.
Yeah.
As well. I'm like, oh, I've got loads of space. Brilliant. I could just do this stuff. It's like, well, you know, hang on. But yeah, shout out to Matthew Rhys on the wing, though.
Oh, yeah. And I mean,
I actually paused the video and kind of, like, yeah, that is that that is that Matthew Rhys out there. Yeah. Shame it didn't go over.
Start of the second half, Matthew Rhys runs a hell of an angle to make a breakthrough.
Oh, yes.
Almost lead to a try as well. Like, Matthew Rhys quietly has a great game while everyone else is imploding around him.
Yeah, Culpin runs 100 metres to finish that try. It's a fantastic finish by him because there's a couple of moments where you go, like, oh, I think he's going to get caught. James Pritchard runs a brilliant support line to block Kevin Morgan from getting to him and allows him to dive over in the corner. And Canada go in 12-9 up at half time, and you just think nothing but fair play. This is shit.
Yep, it's the kind of thing that James Pritchard was great at, was those kind of small technical moments. Like him as a winger was almost ahead of his time. They're wingers that are far more popular nowadays, in the way back then you kind of put them all at fullback. They're kind of like more technical players, and so seeing him on the wing was an interesting thing. Yeah, but runs his line brilliantly.
You're as right, like say, the Andrew Conways and Jack Knowles of the world.
Yeah,
kind of, yeah,
and Emiliano Buffelli as well.
Yes,
a bit of me was sort of relieved Canada got another try, and you were able to point to it and go, no, they were 8 points ahead at half time, and they probably could have been 15, 20 ahead at half time based on kind of balance of play. They were much better. And then you get into the second half, as you say, two things happen at once. Matthew Rhys runs that angle, and Ander Munro goes down in that same passage of play. And even though he gets back up and he continues on, Wales then go, right, okay. And they just bring on Stephen Jones and Gareth Thomas.
You think, like, they need Alfion immediately because it's Dwayne Peel's first time captaining Wales, but there generally seems such an air of panic. And so bringing on those two specifically at the same time, you suddenly think, okay, we might win this now. So Morgan Williams scores at the start of the second half as well,
oh,
just
yeah, of course.
to elongate Welsh panic. He makes his does his tap and go, makes a break, gets tackled not far short of the line. And once again, just Canada are really patient in their build-up of it. Mm. And then eventually, yeah, Morgan Williams sees kind of a gap in a ruck, because there's kind of one of those things where they've got like two rucks sat next to each other and they're kind of intertwined. And then it's Alan Wynne-Jones is on the fringe of it, and he kind of doesn't know which one to mark. And then Morgan Williams just dives through the middle of both of them and finishes another, you know, extremely deserved try for Canada.
Yeah, really well taken. Yeah, yeah. He started with a break himself as well in the lead up. Just part of him having a really excellent sort of first hour or so in particular.
Yeah, I think Parker's at fault for part of that try, isn't he?
I think then he
gets the hook, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that try. And yeah, I would have, you know, I'm sure at the time I would have been thinking, right, you know, half time, come out now, get a few points on the board. I would have sunk into my seat, I'd say, when that went over. Just showed that Canada were building in confidence. It would have been a good half time. But yeah, we managed to dig it out. 25 unanswered points or whatever it would be in the second half. Or more than that, actually,
Yeah, that's what starts immediately when Stephen Jones comes on. His first touch, he throws this wide ball to Shanklin, who breaks the line. Second touch, he gets held up himself over the line after Shanklin gets stopped just short. And his third touch, he then gives the pass for Sonny Parker to score the first try right before, as you say, he's hooked off.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's... Parker takes that on the switch.
Instant his impact. Yeah.
Runs a good line, Parker does. But it's Stephen Jones has clearly mapped that out for a few phases of like, I know exactly what we're going to run here. I know exactly how they're defending, having watched the game for 50 minutes.
Yeah.
And clearly knows exactly what needs to be done. There's another point as well where Wales are under the cosh and he puts in a 22-22 kick, Stephen Jones.
Yes.
He's just unbelievable within sort of 5-10 minutes of coming on.
Yeah. And again, that puts Wales in the position where we then get these two Canadian halfbacks that have been excellent for the first 50-odd minutes, first hour, essentially. Then, out of nowhere, having, as I said, been fantastic, Morgan Williams throws an absolutely terrible pass to Andrew Munro's face, which he then tries to regather, tries to bring down, fumbles completely, drops behind him, tries to just kick anywhere he can. It fumbles. Williams himself tries to regather it. It's sort of just bouncing around everywhere. It's properly chaotic. It's like that Bristol incident a few weeks ago.
Yes. It's like every try in 1987 is what it was like. Yes.
Yeah, it's proper crap 80s football, but rugby and in the noughties.
And what's amazing is that Alan Wynne-Jones scores off the back of this. And it's like, oh, wow, Alan Wynne-Jones really has been playing since the 80s. Because, Morgan Williams for Canada has been fantastic. He's been one of the best players on the field. I have him down as a man of the match contender in my notes. He's utterly fantastic. But in the last 20 minutes, bless him, he kind of goes to shit. Like, that pass is way above Munro's head. And as you say, completely off balance, he tries to kick the ball and it goes about 3 metres, eventually into the hands of Alan Wynne-Jones, who just kind of goes like, oh, right, so do I just score here now? And drives over for what must be one of his first Welsh tries.
Second Welsh try.
Yeah, proper 1987 try there. But it puts Wales back ahead, so...
Was there an added connection at this sort of time with him being from your school, or did you not really care?
Oh no, yeah, we knew he was. There was often a bit of contention in that he was described as going to Llandovery College.
Oh.
And it's like, come on, the fee paying school, come on. So we often bristle a little bit at that when he was described as from there. But yeah, that is partly true. But there needs to be two schools where he's from. But yeah, we were quite aware of him. The other person that was from my sort of era, who was a very good player and had a couple of Wales caps, but never kicked on beyond sevens, is Richie Pugh.
Oh, yeah.
I kind of remember him. He was I remember he was in my primary school and he was an incredibly talented player. People knew him from very, very young age when he was superb and he always was. But I think, yeah, he played a few times for Wales, played quite for the Ospreys, but he was kind of on the sevens circuit. And I think it's quite hard to sort of square being a sevens regular but it's impossible, basically.
Yeah.
Being a 15s regular. But he's involved in coaching now and stuff like that. He's quite well thought of. But yeah, we did know kind of who he was, but obviously had no idea that he'd be playing in like 15 years or 16 no. years time. Hence, I mean, had no idea. And I think he may have still been Alan Jones, I think, in certain places. There was still, I think there's still people who are a bit unsure, aren't they, as to where the win comes.
The WOU squad announcement for this World Cup on the WOU website has it hyphenated with double barrel Alan Wynne Jones. But then you've still got the commentator calling him Wynne Jones, which was more forgivable then than it is now. But you know,
I think it was just Alan Jones's call. I don't think there was a word. But then I kind of no reason to remember if there was or not. But I think it was just Alan Jones.
I'll tell you what, the fact your mate got punched by Alan Jones isn't quite as good a claim to fame.
No. No, I mean, there's plenty of Alan Joneses throwing punches in Wales, aren't there? But there's only one Alan Wynne Jones.
No. Maybe that's what he did. He just made it up to sound iconic. Would he have stayed in the team if he was just called Alan Jones? Would that guy have had a 15
It's like how actors career? Change their names, isn't it? To stand out from the crowd.
Well, it is like that, isn't it? Sometimes being a Welsh rugby fan, when you're like, when there are so many, like Gareth Jones, Gareth Jones from the Scarlets. Oh, which one's that? Which one's that now? You know what I mean? It's like, there's a real period of that, wasn't there? When there was an awful lot of very similar names. And if you're not completely bang on your sort of Scarlet squad players, it's very easy to get them mixed up. So, yeah, it probably makes sense, doesn't it? Give yourself a nickname. I guess Jonathan Davis. Jonathan Fox Davis, Cub Davis. Otherwise, they're such an errant names, aren't they?
No other country has a problem where if you were to make a all-time, like, 30-man squad, feasibly at least two players have got the same name. Like, if both Foxy and Jiffy are in there, they've got the same name. Just as they've both got infamous nicknames.
We watched 87, Jiffy's not in there.
But yeah. So we then, let's keep going, let's power through the other ones.
Yeah, we'll rattle through these.
They'll come really soon after another. So Shane Williams scores two tries in 2 minutes, 3 minutes after Alan Wynne's try, which were all well taken. In the middle, though, he does have a bizarre moment. He breaks out from his own try line, gets up to halfway, then just fumbles the ball and falls over.
The sniper gets in, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He thinks about passing the ball and then just forgets which one's passing it and which one's dropping it. A very bizarre moment. But his second try was particularly a beauty, where Shanks makes this sort of 40-yard metre break. And Gareth Thomas gets in support really, really nicely. Mm. Puts in this really nice kick to just within sort of 5 metres of the Canadian try line. Morgan Williams is back there on his own and ends up fumbling it. Wales turn it over and they're just so efficient in their chase and getting upfield. And they kind of panic and just see how wide they can get it until eventually it just ends up in Shane's hands and they just go, yeah, you could just finish this one.
Shanklin straightens up really nicely. Stephen Jones's ball to put him in is really
fantastic,
lovely and precise. Again, like, not to just wank over Stephen Jones constantly, but he knows exactly the ball he's throwing, exactly where he wants it to go. As eyed up the Canadian defense perfectly, knows this needs, what this requires is Shanklin straightening so that we're not all drifting and we doesn't end up like Shane has a chance early in the second half where he's put into touch because the pass comes too early and it isn't kind of squared up properly. And Stephen Jones throws that kind of like miss two, not the miss three to Shane. No, trust Shanklin to do the pass and the offload. Mm. Excellent. Really well.
And on that first one, there's him, he calls for it from Peel, like as a missing out all of the forwards. And again, he's just really smart. He knows exactly how to get the ball from A to B and what the most kind of efficient process is. So yeah, those two tries both happen within 2 minutes of each other. And it's one of those where you go, thank God for Stephen and thank God for Shane.
And in moments, Tom Shanklin.
Yes. Does he
Tom
score?
Shanklin, well, no, he's a player who, if he is put into space, he will absolutely take it every time.
Yes, yeah.
And he's not necessarily a player who creates or finds space, but if he is put in it, he will make the most of it every single time.
Good at open play, isn't he? Like, he makes the right decisions of when to pass, when to kick, when to just run. Yeah, no, as you were saying earlier, Luke, like, you forget what a good player Tom Shanklin was. I think you get a certain image of Tom Shanklin in your mind. Then you watch him in a game like this and you go, like, oh, well, you know what? Actually, he stood up when he needed to.
Mm. Yeah, I think he's a fantastic player. I mean, he'd be in the Wales 15 now, wouldn't he? If he was still playing, I think we could do with a player like him in the centres. But yeah, I mean, he's a joy to watch, I think. And maybe he's a little bit unfashionable maybe at the time when there were some other more kind of flashy players around him. But yeah, I mean, he was the best starting back here. I thought Peel was a little bit weak. I thought Hook was a little bit disappointing. I thought Kevin Morgan was actually quite quiet, considering there was, I'm sure he went into that game thinking it's going to be a fair bit of space for me here, but he didn't see too much of Kevin Morgan. And yeah, I mean, Mark Jones was a little bit kind of quiet. I mean, he came into it in the second half. He still did quite a lot of good stuff as ever, but didn't score any tries because he wasn't really a try-scoring winger, was he?
No. That was the weird Mark Jones affliction, like, nothing summed him up better than that France game in 2008, where he goes 90 metres and doesn't quite finish it in what would have been one of the all-time great Welsh tries.
Yeah, probably the greatest all-time Welsh try, but he doesn't. How often do you reckon he thinks about that?
Oh, every day. He scored the greatest 5 meter line cross of all time. The thing is, a winger like Mark Jones probably wouldn't happen nowadays. Like a winger who doesn't score many tries and has less kind of out and out gas as certain others will. But he was so solid, and like I really like have good memories of Mark Jones as a Welsh fan. So yeah, it's a funny one.
This is one of the few kind of like hot prospects, isn't he, in like Welsh coaching?
Youngish
guys.
I mean, Eddie Jones offered him a job. And he turned it down because he'd just gone to Worcester. And he figured, you know, I should at least coach a game with them before moving on. Not that I did, you know, half of Eddie Jones' appointments any good, but there we go. So should we move on to Man of the Match and Dick of the Day and wrap this up?
Yeah, last try scored by Colin Jarvis. Yeah, Stephen Jones makes a break.
Lovely stuff. There we are. Which I think we'll come on to. We start on Man of the Match. Will, do you want to begin?
Sure. I've got, two Canadian players written down. One of them is Morgan Williams. He's utterly fantastic, and I'm still tempted to actually give it to him. I thought Spicer at 12 Gander, we've not really talked about him, but he was really good, because like his left boot was such a huge part of the Canadian game plan that just ripped us apart in the first half, us being Wales, of course. I think Gethin Jenkins played well. I think around the park he did a lot of really good stuff, but frankly, like, given the discourse that surrounded what we're doing in this game, I have to give man the match to Stephen Jones. He only played half an hour, but I feel like if he came on for either team, whichever team he came on for would have won. Yeah. And I feel like he did that for Wales and completely turned the game. So I can't see past him.
Luke, where do you stand?
I've gone for Morgan Williams myself. I've got written down here. I mean, I think, yeah, he did fade. I mean, they all did fade after an hour. But I thought he was fantastic to watch for that hour. I think he did so many good things. Great hair.
Yes.
Well, kind of like sort of Disney Prince hair. I looked him up to see who he was playing for, and obviously looked at the Google images, and he had frosting at one point.
Nice.
He had a short back and side, so his hair moved with the times as well. But yeah, Morgan Williams, obviously great Welsh name as well, so obviously good lineage. But yeah, I think Morgan Williams would be my man of the match. I think from a Welsh point of view, I probably would have gone with Shanklin. But yeah, I think Morgan Williams, I think, would deserve a champagne, even if he was on the losing side.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was excellent. Yeah, I think great selection.
Those were the 2 hours torn between. I think Morgan Williams was probably, on balance for most of the game, the best player on the pitch. But then Stephen Jones came on, and I think he has a bigger impact on the eventual result than anyone else. So it becomes a what are you deciding man of the match
on. It's an ethical debate here.
Yes. And I think, on balance of the fact that the scoreline eventually is a Welsh win by 20 plus points, I feel like I have to go for Stephen Jones. But at the same time, it's kind of like head is saying Stephen Jones, heart is saying Morgan Williams, and both want to mention Andy Munro and Tom Shanklin, as you mentioned, plays very well. Also, there's a moose in a hat supporting Canada on the sideline, and I think that's a man of the match contender as well.
Certainly up there.
But yeah, I think Stephen Jones is just about my man of the match. Sneaks it.
It feels harsh to not give it to a Canadian player, doesn't it? But
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. To move on to Dick of the Day very quickly, though, because I think it's a very easy choice, but also the camera briefly cuts at the start of the anthems. So originally, there was a whole thing the commentators mentioned that Wales was supposed to sing their anthem second, they end up singing the first. So when the Canadian anthem starts, it cuts to the Welsh bench, and we can see Kerry Sweeney starts to sing and then stops himself. and I think that is a Dick of the Day nomination-worthy moment, but I'm not giving it to anyone other than James Hook for Love Nor Money.
Fair enough. I mean, Hook's one guy I had written down. Firstly, for the fact that he did a really bad slap on the Canadian 7 Biddle.
Yes.
Secondly, for the fact he threw an intercept, you know, that's another thing. I mean, Shane Williams, I got written down for the fact he got by the sniper in the second half. But ultimately, my dick of the day is Alex Popham, because he, at the end of the game, on his own try line, tried to run it out off a scrum 5, passed to Mark Jones, who was already in touch. So Alex Popham's my dick of the day.
That's
for that.
Entirely fair. And Luke?
Not a player, I'm afraid, but a sort of administrative / business, probably a committee. But the people that designed and approved the Wales shirt.
Oh.
I think. We didn't touch upon it, but it's just grey. Just a grey shirt. There's no real design to it. The Rugby World Cup logo looks too big on it. Mm. There's no flair. The shirt is meant to be eye-catching or inspiring or memorable, and it just does none of those things. I don't believe it is worn again.
No, you're right.
By Wales. So just a complete waste of time. Missed opportunity. You know, you think of the lovely like green kit in 95. You could do a lot, with it, but it's just really, really bad. There was probably some guff about it being like slate mines of Dolgellau or something like that.
It's always the way, isn't it? Inspired just, by coal.
I think it strays over into those Friday night autumn internationals where we try out against someone in a bad kit that we'll never wear again. And I swear the players look at it and think, oh, it's this kind of kit, is it? It's one of those days.
It leaves a sour taste. Right. Grey is very much not Gavin Henson's colour.
No, I mean, I think if Henson had been there, he probably would have had some impact on the kits, and he would have, you know, it would have been a gorgeous sort of green and white number or something like that. Like, yeah, I would say the kit or the kit maker, if I can put that in there.
Look good, play good. In this case, neither.
I thought all in all, it felt a bit to me like, you know, Wales versus sort of New Zealand in one of many games that we've all watched, where we actually do quite a lot of good stuff and score some good tries, and are actually quite proud of it. But at a glance, it's clearly a comprehensive defeat. It just felt a bit like that to me. If I was Canadian, I'm like, oh, we did really well. Mm. Got a lot to be proud of, but ultimately we've been stuffed, and that's what it felt like to me.
Yeah, big like, are we the bad guys? Energy.
We're the bad guys. Yeah, you know, rather than like Christian Cullen coming on or someone, it's Stephen Jones, but it's still kind of the same principle. Oh, shit, this guy's good. He knows what he's doing. But yeah, poor old Canada. Kind of been downhill since there, hasn't it?
Yeah. Bless him.
All because they hired
it's our
off.
Fault.
Never mind.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's Wales' fault. I think that's it, maybe. He's really salty about this game and has just orchestrated their downfall ever since.
Mm. They never recovered from Tyrese Thomas coming off the bench. they were shook in their boots after that.
What tends to happen to central teams?
He's got a very big smile, doesn't he? Thomas, his big happy smile on his face at the end. I was like, I remember him.
Yeah,
and absolutely delighted.
One of those players that never settled on a haircut, and good on him for that.
Rare in a Welsh hooker.
Yeah.
I think we got the bonus point, and I think we can push Australia well, and obviously we'll beat Fiji. And I'm looking forward to listening to the pod and seeing who we get in the sort of quarterfinals. Maybe we can push on then. See how Gareth Jenkins gets on in the Six Nations, I suppose.
And he's 12 years ahead as Welsh coach.
By the time we get to the quarterfinals, I'm pretty sure Gav will be back from his injury as well. So you can pretty much count us getting to the semis.
It's all nailed on. Luke, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for that.
No,
where can people find you on social media? Where can people find the book? Where can people go and buy it if they don't happen to be by Waterstones in Swansea?
Mr. Luke Upton on Twitter is probably the best place. I think there's a link on my bio there as the place you can get the book. But yeah, the most recent book is Rugby's Greatest Mavericks. And then before that was Hard Men of Rugby. Before that was Absolutely Huge, which is the spoof autobiography. I think that might be available for a really quite low sum on Amazon right now, actually. Absolutely Huge. I think it's a couple of quid on there. But yeah, if any of those books sound interesting, you can get them Waterstones, Foyles, Amazon, obviously, or independent bookshops, because it's normally actually the same price as Amazon there. And if they don't have it, they will order it in for you, and it'll normally be in there in a day or two. So kind of please get the book any way you like. But if you are able to get it at an independent bookshop, I think that is the best thing. But no, really, really enjoyed it, boys. I think it's a great idea. I think you could do one of these, but for every single game in the Cardiff Swansea Rebel season of 1978.
We'll add that to the list. That's the next one. We're doing the 1987 Premiership. All the Rugby World Cups.
All the Reese Witherspoon movies.
Yeah.
All the Rugby League World Cups. And now, we're adding up the Rebel season. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Luke, thanks so much for coming on. Just wanted to say I really appreciate it. Love your work, of course. Always appreciate the thoughts and opinions of a fellow rugby nerd, you know, who has put some excellent words on paper before. So can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you very much, boys. Keep up the good work. And I'm going to look forward to finding out what happens in the rest of the tournament.
I can't wait to find out. Starting with next week, please, thank you for listening. Join us next week when the game will be, for fans of Tier 2 nations scoring 17 points against misfiring Celtic teams, Ireland 32, Namibia 17. What a thriller we have
it's
in store
be a cracker.
There. Luke, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. Luke. Will, thank you as ever. And thank you to everyone that's listened at home. I bid you all good night.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.